I think it's still valid. It's a phrase, laugh and the world laughs with you. Have you heard of that? It's attributed to a late 19th century poet called Ella Wheeler Wilcox. I didn't know that. I had to look that up. But I just think that's such a wonderful phrase because I do think if just that sums it up really, because when you are fun and you are laughing, people, you will take people along with you.
Welcome to the Ideas on Stage podcast, your regular insight into leadership communication.
Hey, Aileen, welcome to the show.
Hello, Andrea. Nice to meet you.
Yes, and thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Today, we're going to talk about humor in communication. And let's say, Aileen, that somebody has just clicked on this podcast. What would you tell them in terms of why they should stick around and listen to this conversation? What will they get out of this conversation?
Well, I'd like to think that they would go away thinking that women are funny, which has been the whole reason I set up Funny Women in the first place, and that we can all use humour in our communications, whether that be for our personal development or for our business life. I think there's always this sort of overriding thing between comedy and humour, and I kind of like to separate them because humour is generally as a medium is very different to what I would label as comedy, because humour is intrinsic to our whole way of life. Not just for our entertainment, but it is also important for our interactions, both personally and professionally. And the lines really do blur. I spend a lot of time explaining that to people. And then when we get into the whole sort of funny women thing and why I started Funny Women, which was because I got told by a man, male promoter, that women weren't funny, then that sparks another whole conversation off, because I think women's humour is slightly, it is different to men's. It's, it doesn't invalidate either of them, but actually women use their humour in a rather different way to men, even if we don't realise it. And I think once you understand that, then that really helps with our communications generally between the genders. It's quite normal for men to behave in a sort of funny way and to use their humour, but it's not always seen as particularly ladylike for a woman to go, you know, sort of joking away into the boardroom or introducing a business conversation with a joke. I mean, possibly we don't do that in quite the same way either, but we still use our humour in a very kind of human, intuitive way. And I think that's probably the biggest area of confusion that you get around the whole idea between humor and comedy. I think that explains it. Okay.
Yeah. No, it does. And Lynn, so you mentioned, of course, with you work predominantly with, or maybe only with women. And so tell me a little bit more about, why do you think is the case that there are some gender-specific differences when it comes to using humor, mainly in a professional setting?
Okay. I'm curious. Well, just to kind of recap, why I set Funny Women up was because I think I just mentioned that a male promoter told me women weren't funny. And I have a whole back career of PR and marketing, and the reason this person told me women weren't funny is because I worked as a publicist for a comedy club, and they never booked any women. They never, you know, night after night, it was male comedian after male comedian. And I questioned that. I said, look, you know, I'm here to promote the club, but you never book any women, why not? And I was told categorically, women aren't funny and there are no funny women. And so Funny Women has become my life's work. I've spent the last 20, I think it's actually 22 years now since I first set it up, trying to provide a sort of safe place for women to develop their skills comedically, not just as performers, but as writers and creators, filmmakers. And, you know, I can honestly say now, looking back on it, that women really are funny and we just go about it in a different way. So at a very base level, I do believe that everybody is funny we have different ways of dealing with humor, but we all have the ability to make each other laugh. And it's an instinctive skill. And, you know, as humans, we use that skill at different levels. So parents, I think it's a really the most obvious one. When we have children and kids cry, how do we get them out of crying? Well, we pull funny faces, we tickle them, we play peekaboo. You know, it's such a basic instinct to use humor to change a mood. I'm not suggesting you go around tickling your work colleagues, but it might be fun. You never know. but if you just remember that, you know, you can change a mood and you can switch a conversation around with a lightness of touch. That is probably the most important thing that we can all learn from how to use humour. When it comes to the sexes and the difference, women, in that respect, women have the closest bond with their offspring. And so we're possibly more in direct connection with that ability to access our innate sense of humour. It's such an early form of communication. And then what happens, I don't understand it entirely, but as we get older, we sort of lose our confidence in our ability to do this. And then we get older and we become more self-conscious. I think we hit peak level of self-consciousness at around puberty, when our bodies are telling us that we're becoming sexually active and we've got to attract the opposite sex. And I think that's when the male-female divide comes in, because men tend to use humour as a form of attracting a mate. I use a phrase which might seem a little bit crass, but, you know, men, whatever they look like, can feel very comfortable using humour to attract the opposite sex, whereas a woman wouldn't do that in the same way. I think funny women are a bit scary and seen as mouthy and perhaps a little bit bold. So we're conditioned as women to respond and laugh at men. I am talking, by the way, about traditional male-female relationships here. So when we get into the sort of the gender bending area of it, you've got to look at this either side of that. But, you know, in a very general male stroke female way, that's how men and women are sort of conditioned to respond. So, you know, it is rooted in human courtship. And I think if you then translate that into the workplace and how we behave as men and women, some of that must come through into our professional communications. I'm in my 60s and I have seen things change quite dramatically in my workplace lifetime. And now women are much more confident around using humour and being outspoken and saying what they think. But I can assure you it wasn't like that when I started my career in my 20s. It was a bit of a put up and shut up situation. So, you know, I think there has been a lot of change, and I think as women, we are embracing that more and more. And I know that men are much more respectful of women being more outspoken, and possibly still need to learn about how we use humour. But that's another whole discussion, really.
Yeah. And perhaps we can get there today. You mentioned that as women, for example, should embrace humor in communication, in professional settings. In general, I would say we should all do it, whether you are a woman or a man. But what do you think? Why? Why is humor so important in communication, particularly in a professional context?
When it comes to business and communications in general, humor is just the best thing for helping you to be memorable as a speaker or a communicator of any kind. And it's also, you know, if you use it in advertising or communications or marketing, people always remember the funny stuff, always. So it's such a brilliant way of making your content totally memorable. I've been at loads of conferences and events where I've listened to the people going out of the auditorium, and you always say, oh, I really like that speaker. He or she was really funny. That seems to be like the common thread. And humour is seen as something as a very attractive human quality. So definitely that would be top of my list. When it comes to advertising and marketing, if you think of some of the most amazing adverts are always the funny ones, you know, the one sort of things like the Cinzano ads with Leonard Rossiter and Joan Collins, which are quite old now, but people still talk about them. I think probably 30 years on, they're still like a fantastic, fantastically funny. And those wonderful Specsavers ads, which are totally go into our human condition and exemplify how funny everyday life is. So if you think about it like that, if you can take that into your sort of business communications, that's really going to help you to get some sort of cut through. You don't have to be telling jokes. I do find it quite annoying when people immediately when they meet me say, oh, you work in comedy, tell me a joke. Well, actually, I don't tell jokes. Number one, I'm not a comedian. And number two, when I'm working in comedy, I'm usually much more working, I coach people, and I'm trying to get them to tell their story with humour rather than getting them to sort of tie themselves in knots trying to write jokes. Jokes is a very specific thing. And if you want to be a comedian and go and tell jokes on stage, there is a technique for that and you can use it, but it's not appropriate for everyone. I also know some really great performers, actors, comedians who really don't tell jokes in a traditional way. They just tell amazingly funny anecdotes and stories. So again, it's just such a huge spectrum of how you can use it. When you're using humor in a professional context, you're really cleverly building your community around you. You can create an environment, you can draw people in, you can find amazing things out about people by just sharing a sort of funny anecdote. Because usually what happens is that when you tell a story, someone else will respond with the story. So it's a great way of breaking down barriers, getting people to relax and enjoy each other's company. And I don't think we use that enough in a business context. It's all, you know, it's about, I do think that the best meetings and events and speakers really don't overthink it. They just go with the flow and they just are themselves. You know, there's so much talk about sort of training and coaching around public speaking. I think sometimes we frighten ourselves into not doing anything. And so it's quite nice just to sort of relax with people and enjoy the flow of a conversation. And if you can then take that kind of ability into your more public presentations, you'll definitely build more of you will build more of a rapport with your audience. It's a tricky one because I think, you know, we label people as comedians in a sort of rather glib way. But a comedian is a very different thing to somebody who is a funny speaker. They're two very different entities, because you can be a really funny and amusing speaker, but you would be totally different to a professional comedian. But there are some parallels, definitely. And it's more around the technique and how you build your material that where the two things meet.
Yeah, and why is it like in your view, Lynn, that on the one hand you shared so many benefits of using humor in communication, in business communication as well, and one of the things you mentioned at the beginning is that it's a human quality.
Yeah.
At the same time, we're talking about humans. A lot of humans find it very hard or sometimes uncomfortable to do that, to use humor in professional settings. In your experience, why do you think that's the case? What are some of the obstacles that people face when it comes to using humor in business communication?
I think the biggest thing that is an obstacle, not just in business communications, is when someone tells you to be funny. The minute somebody does that, and they give you a sort of signal that you, hey, you know, do a talk and you've got to be funny. That is almost like, oh my God, you know, the old adrenaline kicks in, fight or flight, you panic, it's really difficult to put people in that situation. And if you're briefing anyone, I would strongly advise that you don't just go blatantly out and say and ask them to be funny, because that is going to put anyone off, particularly if they're not comfortable around humour. Because actually, humour is very intrinsic to our human condition. We use it very naturally, and that's what you want to achieve. And if you think about the way our bodies are set up, we have this wonderful thing called the endocrine system. It monitors our hormone levels, and we often, what we do very naturally physically is balance out our hormones by using various techniques in our body, various devices of our body, laughter being an absolutely key one. Laughter is so important. So if we have a shock, or we're nervous, or we're grief struck, or we've fallen over and hurt ourselves, we often do this kind of, everyone refers to as a nervous laugh. But what you're doing is sending out a signal to your endocrine system to start producing things like serotonin and dopamine, all the nice happy hormones, as I call them, to get rid of all the bad stress hormones like cortisol, and also to increase your production of adrenaline, which helps you to recover if you're in that fight or flight mode. So I love that idea that we look at our bodies as a balance, and then our minds are sort of kind of controlling that. And we're able to quickly rebalance our systems by laughter, which goes back to the whole thing I mentioned about parents and children and how we get our kids to stop crying if they've kind of got upset. So it's so basic. It's almost too basic. But we somehow manage to forget all of this as we grow up and become more aware. And I think it's a factor of the modern age. We're just sort of, we're all so stressed trying to get through life and keep up with everything and answer all our emails and check our social media. We often just forget to stop for a minute and have a think and a relax. And you know, the minute you relax, if you had a stressful day or something's gone a bit wrong, and you just give yourself a minute, you just naturally fall into this kind of, oh dear, you know, I'm going to have a bit of a laugh about myself. It just sets everything off. It balances everything out. Even just by smiling, you can kind of reset your hormonal balance, which is why things like laughter yoga and all those kind of slightly hippy-dippy things are more important than people realize. They make quite a difference. You know, just by smiling, you're sending out a sort of signal to your brain that you need to release more of the happy hormones.
And you made me think that you're talking about laughter now, but there are many things, I guess, Lynn, that are part of who we are, as humans. But then somehow, for some reason, as we grow older, we stop doing it, or we forget about these things. And also, when it comes to humor, what I hear, let me know if that's the case for you as well in your field, is that a lot of people have these and see these disconnection, if you want, between being funny or using humor in communication and being serious and professional, and some people think that the two don't go hand in hand. So maybe we should strike the right balance. I don't know if there is such a thing as the right balance, but what do you think, what would you tell people who are hesitant to use humor because they think that if they do that, then they will appear less professional, less serious?
Yeah, I mean, there's always a level of appropriateness, and you know, what comedians tend to do is take it beyond that. So because they're trying to get a laugh, and quite often they'll use a shock tactic to get a laugh, which would not be appropriate in a business context. So yeah, so you've got to know your level, and you've got to know, well, most importantly, you've got to know your audience. So a great comedian, to use that example, regardless of what material they're going to use, they always, a really good performer in any situation, checks out their audience. They understand who they're speaking to. So, you know, if you're going to be going to talk to a load of rugby players, you're not going to trot out your jokes about eyelashes and face masks. you know, that's a very bad example, but that's just to, you know, just to give you an extreme. You've got to know who you're talking to. And I've seen some really unlikely people command an audience that is very different to them by just knowing who they're talking to. And it's so simple to do. If you're a public, if you're speaking at a conference or something, you go and you speak to the organizer and you say, who's in the audience? What is the demographic? What kind of businesses are they in? Most of it is blatantly obvious, but you'd be surprised how many people show up and they don't, haven't done their research. So knowing your audience is key. Appropriateness, well, if you tap into your into your intuition and you use all your human experience, you should know what is appropriate, particularly in a business context. In a business context, you're not there to be a comedian. You're there to communicate information. But humor is a really important device. But, you know, you can get it wrong if you have if you show that you're not up to date with their latest bit of research, or they've stopped selling a product and you've included that in a presentation. I mean, they're the obvious things. But just, I suppose the way of doing that is to make sure that you've spoken to the people who are running the event beforehand. If you are if you're a comedian, a good comedian goes in and will check out who's in the audience before they go on. But, you know, sadly, quite a lot of them just show up for the gig, do their 20 minutes and then disappear. And that sometimes causes quite a lot of problems if you're a comedy producer like I am, because what the worst thing that can happen, I've seen this happen in a business conference context as well. Someone's arrived just in time for their set, gone on stage and done almost the identical material to the person before them. I've seen that happen at a conference as well. So I always think it's good to be in the room a little bit before you're on stage. Check out what people are talking about. If you're not sure, go and ask somebody. Also check the term, you know, the way the business is operational. So a lot of us, myself included, will have their own sort of guidelines on their websites and things about their diversity and inclusion, you know, sort of guidelines, what they stand for as a business. All these things are actually really easy to find out now, because what businesses don't have a website? Nearly everyone has a website now. So, and worst case scenarios, pick up the phone. I mean, I don't think we use the phone enough these days. I still quite like the fact having a conversation with somebody can really communicate a bit of information much more quickly than if you rely on emails backwards and forwards. So, you know, if you want to have a briefing with your client or a briefing with your speaker before an event, a phone call is like the best way, still the best way. And it takes less time, I actually think, as well. I think we don't use it enough.
I agree with you so much. I think what you've just shared is one of the most important principles in communication, starting with the audience, understanding the audience, which goes beyond, I think, just humor in general. Like in communication, yes, we need to start from the audience. And also, I also agree with you that sometimes I get asked, yeah, but how do I have the information? I don't know who the audience is. Often,
ask.
Ask. The reason why we don't know who the audience is often because we don't ask either ourselves the right questions or somebody else. It could be the conference organizer. It could be your client. It depends on what the context is. But yeah, starting with the audience, number one principle. And Lynn, you mentioned that, for example, that you gave us the example of, I think it was in your comedy clubs or maybe at a conference, like two speakers, because they didn't do the preparation to understand the audience. Yeah. They came there 20 minutes and they shared very similar things. Do you have any other anecdotes, examples, things that you remember of communication that went wrong, or maybe humor wrong? Can you think of anything?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've got a couple of really good examples, but the from my from what I do, I mean, I am very reliant as somebody that runs a non-profit comedy platform, very specifically for women. I'm very reliant on funding from sponsors and partners and that kind of thing. And I learned my lesson very early on in Funny Women's history when I had a big event for, I think it was actually International Women's Day. And we had a big cosmetic brand had put some money into the event to support us. And they'd given a load of product away to put in the goodie bags. And the host, who had been briefed, and this I'll come to that in a minute, but a comedian host had been briefed about the sponsors and to be nice and to talk about them, decided in the interval, just before the interval, that she would remind everyone that they're going to get a goodie bag when they left. And she got one of the goodie bags and started pulling the contents of it out. And she held up a lipstick and said, lipstick. Oh, that's shit. And everyone laughed. They thought it was funny because really what it was doing was poking fun at this cosmetic brand that will remain nameless. And you can guess what happened, because in the interval, I just was like furious, because I thought, oh my goodness me, what am I going to do? So I went to go and find the client that was there in the audience, and they'd left. They'd gone. And I can't remember if we ever worked with them again. We didn't. But, you know, that was definitely not appropriate behaviour by our host, who shouldn't have done that. But that leads me on to what I call comedy Tourette's, because this is not a single, this isn't an incident that is just my own experience. I've seen other people go through this, and it's also puts up a barrier. So when people are asking me to find them a comedy host, one of the most frequent things they say to me is they won't slag off the client, will they? And I have to pretty much guarantee that my comedians or my hosts that I'm booking for those events won't slag off the hand that's feeding them. But there's just something weird that goes on in a comedian, not all comedians, but just in certain people's minds, is that the minute you tell them not to do something, their comedy Tourette's kicks in and they do exactly the opposite of what they're being asked to do. And it does make, therefore, I can see why people find booking a comedian to host an event or whatever as, you know, sort of connected with a risky strategy. This incident of mine was a long time ago, and I don't think anything like that has ever happened again. But I now just, as a producer, I just really underline it, which is that these people are paying for you to be here at this gig. Do not slag them off. You know, be nice about their products. At the very least, just mention them. If you don't like it, just don't say anything, you know, or just leave it out. You know, if you're not sure about something, leave it out. That's another tip, really, which is if you're not sure, it's better to say nothing than to say something that will offend people. But yeah, I mean, that's probably the worst thing that's ever happened to me. It's a tricky one. I think sort of really good comedians that do a lot of corporate hosting are really mindful of that and are really good, and they do their homework. I booked quite a well-known comedian for a corporate gig that we've booked many times, where we got hosts for them. And the last time around, I booked somebody quite well-known, and she was just amazing because she does her homework. She contacted me, she'd asked for briefing notes, she said, tell me about, I think it was an awards event, she said, what are the awards, what do they get it for? A really good, if you're being paid quite a lot of money to do something, you should at least do your homework. And that is again about knowing your audience, it all feeds back into that. So that was a pretty horrific experience, not one I'd like to repeat ever again.
I can imagine, but it does happen. Out of curiosity, Lynn, so you mentioned that perhaps that client never worked with you again because of what happened. Have you worked with their host again? Just out of curiosity.
Oh, no, I haven't actually. But not for that reason. There was another incident a few years later, but
Yeah, okay.
I think it's interesting because I think what you do, I don't manage talent. I book talent and I produce events. So I can pick and choose who I want to work with according to budgets and appropriateness and all those things. And I think when someone's sort of done a few things wrong, they don't put their own reputation at risk. They put Funny Women's reputation at risk. So I have to protect that. And people are coming to us as experts to help them book somebody great to host their event or do a keynote speech or whatever. So if that speaker or comedian gets it wrong, it affects our reputation. Not necessarily.
I can totally relate to that, Lynn. Some time ago, it happened. Something, like if I think about the outcome, something similar to me. One of our clients, they asked us to do something, and what they were looking for was somehow connected to what we do as a company. But it wasn't exactly our area of expertise, and so we collaborated with someone else, with an external expert, if you want. But then same thing, for some reasons it didn't work at all. But then exactly what you said, it's not just that their program, that thing didn't work. In the end, even if that person was external, it was the Ideas on Stage reputation
And I think, you know, your speakers or your comedians or your talent or however you want to position them, if they want, they should respect that, you know. And if they don't, it's time not to work with them anymore. We have a wonderful expression, which is aggravation exceeds talent, you know. And it's very interesting because in the world of comedy, some of the nicest people to work with and the most generous and the most diligent are possibly not the best or the funniest comedians, but they are just brilliant at understanding what we want as Funny Women or what the client wants. And that's what it's about, because you don't always have to, you know, comedians by their very nature, it's a very self-indulgent, slightly self-obsessed type mindset. Obviously it has to be for you to be able to, you know, talk about yourself on stage. So, you know, if you've got to take it down a notch, if you want to do the corporate work and be paid lots of money by commercial corporate clients, you can't get away with being, you know, you can't go too far. You've got to be a little bit mindful. As I think I said earlier, you know, you don't bite off the hand that feedeth. They're the people that are paying for you to be here. Respect that, but have fun with it, because that's why they've hired you, but don't abuse it. I think that's it. And I think obviously we both had similar experiences, and it does make you nervous. And worse still, it makes our clients nervous. And I spent 20 years now trying to get people over that hump and to accept that comedy is fantastic for your business, and we know it is in all sorts of ways, but you know, the minute you have a bad experience, it does put you in a very vulnerable situation.
Yeah. And it goes back to what you mentioned: homework, preparation, understanding the audience, understanding the context as well.
Yeah.
So it's not just about knowing who the audience is.
That's
but
right.
What's the context? Some things work in a certain context. Other things don't work in the same context. And
the wonderful thing about having access to a lot of different talent, you know, in my case, mainly female, I do work with male comedians as well, but mainly I book female talent. We pretty much know who's good at what, and there is kind of a match for all sorts of things, you know, and that again, trust us to find somebody that is right for your event. And, you know, because we do all female, you know, the classic things like International Women's Day and summertime themes or Christmas or any, you know, you tend to get to know after doing it as long as I have, who's got the material that works with those situations. So it is kind of like a sort of jigsaw puzzle of putting everyone together, particularly if you're booking more than one act for an event or more than one speaker.
Yeah. And Lynn, so we started this conversation by talking about some of the like gender specific challenges and or advantages when it comes to using humor. What about cultures? So again, in your experience, is there anything that we should be aware of or consider when it comes to using humor across cultures and making sure hopefully that it works across different cultures?
Well, you've got a lot in that mix, haven't you? Culture is religion. You've got ableism. You've got ageism. What we're dealing with now is a much more aware world and a much more sensitive world as well. And at this moment in time, there's a lot going on, which I probably prefer not to get too specifically involved in. But culture in respect of, your religion, where you live. I'm going to use location actually as a good example, because I think that's a safe one. I don't really want to get into the religion thing. But, you know, if you go and you are talking to, you live in London and you go and you've been booked to do an event in Manchester, I'm going to use a comedy context, but if you're a comedian, you wouldn't do your material about using the tube if you're doing a gig in Manchester. What you do is you go away and check out what the nearest equivalent is, or you amend your story to accommodate the modes of transport in Manchester. Cultural appropriation, I would call that loosely, but that's probably the most obvious way of describing it. So there's a very difficult and fine line going on in the world of comedy at the moment between religions, which, as I say, I don't really want to get into because I think it is very sensitive and quite toxic in certain respects because of world events. So but I think that applies, you know, if you're talking to one religious group, don't do terribly bad taste material about them, or avoid it. I mean, if in doubt, leave it out is always my favorite phrase, because if you're not sure about something, just move on and don't do it. Just don't do it. I'm probably a little bit more vocal. I'm happy to be a bit more vocal about both ableism, because the disability lobby at the moment is very strong, and I don't like anything that brings attention to people with disabilities having been considered on anything but an equal level. Because if they're out there as speakers or comedians, they're there because they're either funny or they're brilliant speakers, and that shouldn't come into it. That's why they're there, not because they've got a disability or whatever. And from very, very much my personal experience as an older person, this is the sort of the difficult one, because people don't even realize they're being ageist, and we live in such an ageist society, and it's not until you get to a certain age that you encounter it. And you know that people don't mean to do it, but they do it all the time. They say the most ridiculous things, and that's tricky. So all I would say to anybody is just be aware of it and think about what you're going to say about somebody over 60 before you say it, because a lot of us over 60, myself being a very good example of that, are not retired. They are still working. They are still contributing a lot to society and the economy. And I think women come off on that much worse than men. I think, you know, it's very much that does bleed into sort of sexism as well. But older women get a much worse deal than older men. So really think about that before you start, you know, thinking about, you know, really think about it before you start saying anything very specific. If it's your own lived experience, then you can talk about it. There was a really great example of a comedian who talked about, I think, of an African origin. This is in about 2012. It's quite a long time ago. I wrote about it for I don't know if it's still around, Huffington Post. But there's a whole thing about this female comedian talking about running away from effectively being raped. I think that's what she was talking about. And a lot of people got very upset about her talking about it. But, you know, my argument for that was it was her lived experience. She owned it. Why shouldn't she talk about it? It's all very well, everyone getting all kind of upset about it. But actually, she was making a very good point using humour about how difficult it was coming from her culture and the kind of threats that women in her culture had to live with. And it was very powerful at the time. It did create quite a debate in the national media. But I think that's the thing. If it's your lived experience, you can own it and you can talk about it. But if it's not, don't talk about it.
Hi there. Before we continue with this episode, I just wanted to take a moment to share with you some resources that I believe would be super useful for you. The first one is my book, Confident Presenter. Check it out. You can find it on Amazon. I'm going to include the link in the show notes. It's a book for business owners, leaders, and the teams who want to become more credible, confident, and convincing presenters. To make the most of the book, take the Confident Presenter Scorecard, which is an online tool that allows you to assess your current presentation skills in less than 3 minutes for free. You just need to answer a few questions. The scorecard will give you a score from 0 to 100%. It will tell you what that score means for you, and it will also identify opportunities for improvement. And then the last thing is my web class. I often run free presentation skills web classes where I go through my own process for creating my own presentations and those of our clients. So if you're interested, I'd love to see you there. I'm going to include all the links in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening to a podcast. It means the world to me. Now, let's jump back into the conversation. And also going back to the very first example you gave, London versus Manchester, the tube or not using the tube. Again, this is like classic communication advice that makes a lot of sense. I'm saying this because it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And your ideas here, even if you come from your background, comedy, that's what you do, also what you do. But a lot of these things, and I'm saying this for listeners, is also applicable to business.
Totally.
Business communication.
Yeah.
Making it relevant to your particular audience. Lynn, if somebody would like to maybe give it a try and include more humor in their communication, especially in the professional setting, but they don't know what to do, where to start, what would you recommend? Are there any? It could be anything. It could be some practical tips, some exercises, something to check out. Any ideas?
Someone asked me the other day who just done my, I think they'd just done a comedy day, one of our comedy workshops, and they wanted to have a go at comedy. And they said, what about the gong show at the Comedy Store? I said, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it because that probably has to be the most brutal introduction to the world of comedy you can have, because they literally time you out. If the audience don't like you, they vote you off stage. So, you know, you've got to be really robust to be able to deal with that. You've got to be confident, and you've got to not care if you get one line out and then you get pulled off stage. So, you know, go for where you feel comfortable. The other thing which is really important for comedy, and even if you just want to kind of put some funny anecdotes into your public speaking or your meetings, is popular culture. I mean, it's all around us now. I mean, you can spend your whole day on TikTok looking at funny things. You know, just watch stuff. That's the other thing I find curious, is a lot of people say, oh, I want to be a comedian, but then you find out they've never been to a live comedy gig. Why would you think you want to be a comedian if you've never been into a live environment and watched some live comedy? Go and look at it before you say you're going to do it. Think it through, you know, go and see what other people are doing. Understand what the market is like. If you want to do stand-up comedy, go and visit, go to the Comedy Store, go to, you can get free tickets for things like Live at the Apollo on the BBC. Go to your local comedy gig, which is in a room above a pub, because you then get a feel for all the different levels of it. I mean, that would count for anything, really. Music gigs, comedy gigs, theatrical gigs. I mean, it's a sort of, surely that's just basic research. But I'm still continually shocked at how many people say they want to do comedy. They've got no idea. They think comedy to a lot of people is what they see on the telly, not what is, you know, there's a mile of difference between what's going on the live circuit and what ends up on telly. You know, notwithstanding things like censorship and appropriateness and what have you, so much changes. And a lot of stuff also gets edited and changed, you know, moved around. A lot of what we see on something like Live at the Apollo, they probably, well, I know they record much longer sets, and then all the public sees is like 5 minutes. So, you know, bear that in mind. It's good to go, if you really want to be a comedian, go and look at people starting out in the world of comedy and watch them literally from the grassroots up. I'm passionate about grassroots. I think we don't spend enough time or money on it. I think it's really tough for the whole of the arts world at the moment, because there's no investment in grassroots. So, you know, if you can go and support your local comedy promoter or whatever, do it, because they're all trying to earn a living and do what they love, and help other people. But, you know, there is less and less financial support for that now.
On that point, Lynn, or maybe on a similar point, I heard that Queen, the band, the rock band, before they were Queen, they played, maybe it was in a pub in the UK, in front of six people.
Yeah.
Six people, yeah, Queen. Yeah. Then, of course, they also played at Wembley and all over the world. But before getting to Wembley, and the same is true with comedy, the same is true if you want to be a speaker, if you want to be a great presenter, you don't have to start at Wembley. You can start in front of six people and then gradually.
There is a sea change. Okay. So number one, I've been to the Edinburgh Fringe regularly since 2005. I think I first started going. And I've been the only person in the audience at a gig. I've sat there on my own watching somebody. And, you know, again, the good performers are respectful of that and will still do the same show to one or two people as if it was to 20, 30, 40 people. So that's just a lived experience for those in the comedy world. But there is a big new phenomena, which I think is very relevant to this conversation, which is social media has completely changed things. So we actually run a content creator award for the Funny Women Awards. And every winner for the last 4 years, who has been an online comedian, for the sake of a description, every one of those women who've won that award since we started it, I think it's 4 years, might be five, has gone away from our competition, got a book deal, and three of them that I'm aware of have all gone off and done a tour, a comedy tour, as a performer. Now, the most recent one is a wonderful, really hilarious content creator called her real name is Serena Terry, but she's on Instagram and TikTok as Mammy Banter. She's a Northern Irish mum of two who during COVID decided that she got bored, so she started making funny videos. She put a few out and they literally caught fire, went viral. They're very funny. They're very clever. They're very relatable. We talked about that earlier. The humour is relatable. If you're a mum with kids, you'd watch this and think, oh, yeah, that's just like me. And she talks about her husband and her relationship. She has all sorts of different characters. She plays them all. Very funny. Anyway, she won our Content Creator Award last year. But by the time she'd done that, she'd already been on tour around Northern Ireland. She has 3.5 million followers on social media. And she'd been contacted by a promoter in Belfast who said, can I book you for a gig? And she said, well, I've never done live comedy. I only do online. He said, oh, you can do live comedy. So all credit to her. She said, oh, all right then. So her first ever gig, her first ever live stand-up comedy gig, gone from literally from TikTok to a stage, was to 2,000 people, sold out. And she now tours regularly. I think her biggest audience is 8,500 people. So you can imagine how well that's gone down with people who are still on the grassroots comedy circuit. It's really changing the way people start out in comedy. It's made us really think about how we're going to run our competition going forward. But it's all the power now is in the hands of not just that public audience that sit in front of you, but it's also influenced by the, well, in Serena's case, 3.5 million people watching her. Of course, she's going to sell 8,500 tickets. But, you know, if you're, you know, you've got to start, if you want to go into comedy now, you've got to start thinking about online. It's really interesting, and it's really changing and dividing the world of comedy. I think that's probably relevant to the public speaking world as well, because I know a lot of public speakers who have massive followings, and they will get big audiences if they speak at a business conference. Is that true?
It's very relevant to public speaking in general.
Yeah.
And another very relevant thing that you mentioned earlier, you said you also need to be, you mentioned curiosity, you need to be curious and to pay attention to what's around you.
Oh yeah.
When it comes to, for example, finding that great joke or that great line, but also again, when you give a presentation, say for example you want to include a story that supports the point that you want to make, or it could be an example, it could be an anecdote, it could be an analogy, a metaphor, all these things. Of course, if you have your own material, even better, but often it's just a matter of being curious and paying attention to what surrounds us. And maybe you read something in a book, in an article, you watch a video, and then you keep note, and then you can in the right way, of course, reuse certain things. And
we're just so bombarded, aren't we, though, by information now. I mean, it's almost overkill, you know. And you've, when you're trying to curate things, sometimes the difficulty is knowing what to put in and what to leave out. So I think people are almost blinded into a sort of sense of incapacity by too much over, you know, it's like too much information. But I think if you need to strip that out and really think about, you know, what you're trying to achieve. I also, going back to comedy specifically, if you cut yourself off from the stimulus around you, if you spend your day with headphones in listening to music or sitting on a public transport listening to podcasts, that's all great, but you are missing out on a whole load of life by doing that. I'm not suggesting you don't do it, but do just listen. I mean, that's my biggest tip for anyone. Listen to what's going on around you, because you never know what you're going to hear. And some of the best comedy comes from listening to half a conversation, or just being on the periphery of something. And absurdity of life. And I think we are also closeted in our headphones and our little worlds are, you know, people walk along the street now very fast. They've got their phones in front of them, headphones on. Apart from the fact that I'm getting injured by people doing that all the time, they're also cutting themselves off from the stimulus of life, which I think is so important.
Yeah. No, I agree, Lynn. And as we approach the conclusion of our conversation, I don't know if this is relevant, maybe it is for this particular topic, but if you think about what we talked about today, are there any books that you would recommend to our listeners? I love books, and I don't know whether you've got something in mind for people who want to learn more about humor in communication, comedy, and some of the things we talked about today.
There are so many books on comedy, I think, I don't know, I think there's comedy in literature. If you, I think we need to look at comedy historically as well, and we don't tend to do that because a lot of the patterns of people like, you know, Charles Dickens. I live in Medway; it's Dickens land here. But you know, he was actually probably one of the first performers, comedians, because he used to go out and talk to people and read his books. But if you look at some of the tropes that he writes about, they are funny, funny, funny. And I think it's good to look at that in a narrative sense. Look at people like Charles Dickens. Jane Austen is a particular favourite of mine, because I just laugh thinking about it, because so much of what she writes about is laugh out loud. But then if you want kind of proper comedy books, Logan Murray has written a number of books. He's also runs a brilliant comedy course, and he's passionate about comedy, and I would always trust him to write about stuff in a way that I see it. And then my other kind of go-to comedy guru is an academic called Dr. Oliver Double, who's at the University of Kent, and he's written a number of books, none of which I can remember at the moment, but if you look him up, they will come up. And he will approach it from a much more academic viewpoint. There's lots of academic books on comedy as well. But yeah, again, you can just put in a Google search, you know, learn about comedy, and a million books will come up. But that, I would say, my two bits of advice: look at what's gone before, because I think that's really important. I love a historic context. I think we lose sight sometimes of how comedy is always comedy, whether it was written in the 18th century or the 21st century. There are still things that are common. The other thing I love to do is for female comedy as well, is to look back at the last century at amazing, it's not really books, but things like Lucille Ball, the I Love Lucy show, and Phyllis Diller, and there are so many, I can't even get them all out, but I can probably produce a little list for you to put on the bibliography
that would be amazing. Yeah. Thank you very much, Lynn. And by the way, I also, you made me think about something now which I wanted to mention, something that you, oh yes, you said that something like comedy has always been comedy. I don't remember exactly the sentence you used, but the idea was that, and I think the same when it comes to communication in general. So for example, here is what I mean. Today, everybody talks about artificial intelligence and tools and technology. Now, some of these things are great depending on how we use technology in general, but in communication, for example, Aristotle was the first one, maybe, that more than 2,000 years ago gave us the building blocks for effective persuasion and influencing others and communication in general. Mm. And he didn't have access to any of these tools. And these are fundamental principles of communication. And today's best communicators still follow those principles. Yeah. So I could relate 100% to what you said.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm not big on the classics because I never studied them, but yeah, absolutely. It just goes back from time immemorial. You know, we use that phrase very glibly, but it's true. Nothing changes that much. Yeah. And you know, I'm going back to women as well. Women have always been there. We talk about women being new to it. We're not. We've always been great communicators, and they've always been great female leaders. The late great Joyce Grenfell who operated in the middle of the last century. She was a pioneer in comedy in television. She did loads of her stuff on YouTube. You can watch it, but she was a great raconteur, and she did comedy skits. But if you look at them, they're still fresh now. They still are relevant. A lot of things are, they may be set in a century ago, but they're still dealing with the same themes. What has changed dramatically is the way women have been represented in more general terms, and the fact that women are, they've always been there, but now they have a much more equal platform. And a lot of great, there's a lot of great female comedy represented on in broadcast in television that goes back, you know, 70, 80 years. We are just always battling with that whole equality thing. But hopefully we're sort of through the worst of it now. I think there's still some changes to make, but I do feel that after spending my last 20 years of my life doing it, there is a legacy and we have changed things. I just want to see the last bits of it change. And that isn't necessarily around female comedy. It's around, as you alluded to earlier, you know, the other forms of diversity, of culture, ableism, ageism, all those things need to still be put in the mix.
It's great to hear that the positive recognition coming from you. So, okay. And Lynn, if anybody would like to connect with you and say hi, where do they find you?
Well, I'm on, we've got a website, funnywomen.com, and then we're on all the social platforms, either as at Funny Women. I think Twitter is, Twitter X is at Funny Women, but Instagram is funny_women. Don't ask.
We'll find you in all You'll the platforms, and then yeah, we're going to yeah, include the links yes, in the show
yeah,
notes.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, perfect. So website and social media. And right, so let's do this, Lynn, as we close. Let's say that somebody watches this episode and then for whatever reason, not your fault, maybe my fault, they after some time they forget everything, but let's say that they remember one thing, and if they remember that thing, then you would be happy. What's that thing? What if you think about everything we talked about today, what's the most important thing that you would like our listeners to remember from this conversation?
Gosh, that's putting me on the spot, isn't it? Actually, it's staring me in the face on my computer screen, but I think it's still valid. It's a phrase, laugh and the world laughs with you. Have you heard of that? It's attributed to a late 19th century poet called Ella Wheeler Wilcox. I didn't know that. I had to look that up. But I just think that's such a wonderful phrase, because I do think that sums it up, really, because when you are fun and you are laughing, you will take people along with you, because we are attracted as human beings. Fundamentally, we are attracted to that, as I hope our conversation has demonstrated.
Because that was great. Can you tell me again what the sentence is?
Laugh and the world laughs with you.
Laugh and the world laughs with you. Love it. Okay. Lynn, thank you very much. All the very best. Let's keep in touch.
Thanks, Andrea. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Ideas on Stage podcast, there are many more you might like. So please subscribe, leave us a review, and tell us what you think. You can find many more ideas on business communication at ideasonstage.com or by searching for Ideas on Stage on iTunes, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and goodbye for now.